Oh, hey, welcome to The Look Back with me, your host, Keith Newman, former journalist and media guy and go-to-market consultant in the Valley for the past few decades. Here we have candid conversations with newsmakers and rule breakers, the innovators, entrepreneurs, and influencers who share their past contributions along with current insights in a casual yet candid conversation. This lightly edited passion project of mine is a pay it forward contribution to the next wave of innovators and entrepreneurs. I sure hope you enjoy the program and feel free to share it with anyone who might enjoy it. Now, onto the show. Hey, Steve Blank, welcome to The Look Back.
Thanks for having me, Keith. Really excited for our conversation.
Oh, it's great to reconnect. It has been quite a while. But let me give a quick background because you have such an interesting background. I have to capture it correctly, and then we'll jump into some questions I have and just a good conversation, okay? For my audience, Steve Blank is an adjunct professor at Stanford and a co-founder of the Gordian Knot Center for National Security Innovation. He's also been described as the father of modern entrepreneurship, credited with launching the Lean Startup Movement and the curriculum for the National Science Foundation and Innovation Corp, Hacking for Defense and Diplomacy. He's basically changed how startups are built, how entrepreneurship is taught, how science is commercialized, and how companies and the government innovate. It's been a crazy roller coaster ride for you, Mr. Blank, especially since when we first ran into each other, professionally speaking, when your days running SuperMac and then in a leadership roles at Rocket Science and Epiphany when I was in the media game and you were in maybe pre 1.0 technology companies.
It has been a long, strange trip, that's for sure.
Well, it's so great to have you as part of this, and I can't wait to delve into, you know, a lot of my discussions are around the whole startup ecosystem and the idea of helping early stage companies find the right, you know, path to growth and success. And, you know, you wrote one of the, contributed to the definitive studies on that with the Lean Startup and brought that to Stanford. I'm curious your thoughts about how that applies today. Is it outdated? Is it fully ingrained now? Has it become, I don't want to say obsolete, Steve, because I hear people talk about it still today, but it has been a while. So give me your thoughts on where we are and how much you would change in terms of your book today on the Lean Startup.
So Keith, that's a great question. You know, when we first kind of started talking about the principles of Lean, I thought that this would be a fad and maybe, you know, like, okay, what's next? It turns out, and we'll talk about what some of those principles are, but it turns out to have been kind of foundational and fundamental in some cases. Because it wasn't just a simple evolution of what we used to do in the 20th century as entrepreneurs. Just to remind your listeners, it's kind of hard to believe, but in the 20th century, the way you got funded is you wrote a business plan, which was essentially a document that you wrote and no one actually read. But it was kind of an organizing principle of how do you organize your thoughts. And you put together a five-year plan. VCs looked at it. It always said $100 million in year five. No one actually pointed out the only people who insisted on five-year plans were the Soviet Union and venture capitalists. But in any case, you know, we kind of knew as entrepreneurs, that as operators, that no business plan survived first contact with customers, but there was no alternative. I mean, there literally was no other language to differentiate why you wrote a plan. So the whole Lean Startup method was my work, then Eric Ries's work, and Alexander Osterwalder's work, to realize that startups weren't smaller versions of large companies. That's pretty obvious today. But I have to tell you, at the turn of the century, even after doing startups for decades, that was not ever articulated. And in fact, what we got it down to is large companies execute what we'll call known business models. That is, you know who your customers are, you know pricing, competitors, product market fit, all those are knowns. And therefore, your focus is on execution and scale. But the insight we had, which was a truly unique insight, is that no, startups are searching for business models. And this distinction between search and execution, which is the core of the whole lean methodology, had never been articulated before, at least clearly, though obviously every operator and a good number of VCs understood it. We didn't even have the language to describe it. And I say that to answer your question. What came out of that was a set of tools and methodology to deal with searching for a business model. We call that the lean method. And today we take for granted the words pivot, MVP, get out of the building. You know, those are so ingrained to what we do as startups and entrepreneurs, we would never like consider doing anything else. So to answer your question, no, I didn't think it, I guess it's not a fad anymore, but it will be replaced. And later on, I'll tell you what I think is going to replace it. Oh, what was your question, Keith?
Yeah. Because I think I did skip over what was the lean method. Okay. In terms of, I almost feel like people already know it, but the way startups pitch their business today, no one's doing really five-year financials, are they? Are we really writing long business plans? Maybe some companies do, but nothing that I've seen.
Well, business plans are, you know, my objection to the plan is we were doing a plan before we had done any planning, meaning we had no data. So in fact, what I still suggest is we ought to write business plans, but we ought to teach them in the English department because they're the best example of creative writing that you'll ever do without any facts. The minute you actually get out of the building and gather some facts, then you can actually write down something of a plan. Here's what we found when we talked to 50 people and built a set of minimum viable products and whatever. Now you could start talking about, here's our go-to-market strategy. Here are some of the other ways we want to build the product. And here's what we understand about our customers. Kind of hard to do sitting inside of a building, thinking great thoughts.
So you want to encourage these startup companies or my advisors or investors to tell startups, get out into the marketplace, socialize your concept, understand what the customer's real needs are and how you're going to solve those, how you remove the pain, how you take the frown and turn it upside down, and how it's going to be infinitely profitable. How do you advocate that they communicate that story then, if not in the larger business plan?
So first of all, I would disagree. That's not what I would tell my startup. What I would tell them at first is all you have on day one is a set of untested hypotheses, which is a fancy word for all you're telling me is a set of effing guesses. And I won't say the word F out loud, but that's all most great founders have is a passion that implicitly, and here's the key, implicitly they think they understand the customer problem or need and therefore has jumped to a solution that they want to build. And I go, the reason I want you outside the building, the reason I want you to do MVPs is just humor me. Humor me that like you really have nailed this thing and just talk to 10 people and prove to me that you absolutely understand this. Now, of course, they usually come back a little shell-shocked and go, well, they don't get it. or I must have talked to the wrong 10 people. Now we could have a conversation. And those are first-time entrepreneurs. Second-time entrepreneurs get it much quicker. Why? Because they've taken down the wrong path and they've discovered that what they believed, you know, 2 years later really wasn't facts, etc. But first-time entrepreneurs, you got to just tell them, humor me. Just find me some people who agree with the assumptions you've made. And a hypothesis is a fancy Stanford word because the students pay a lot of money, but it just means you're guessing or you have a set of assumptions. And the whole model of customer development is how do you rapidly validate this stuff before you pour time and money and people into building something that people don't want or need.
So the idea being streamline the process of writing a very in-depth business plan, but get to the core tenets.
Yeah, the business plan is nothing more than an organizing document of how you're going to build and scale the company mm-hmm. and what your plan to do so is. But yes, as you just said, how do I validate whether any of those are true? And can I validate them before I spend my time doing all that writing?
Are you okay with a startup coming to you to present a business plan or a business idea in a PowerPoint kind of a presentation versus a thought out document?
Well, remember, I'm not a VC, so it depends. Your mileage may vary. Yeah. I get this from students, though, all the time, right? I teach four entrepreneurship classes at Stanford. And you know, given that they usually are very smart about either a technical domain or just smart in general, you want to listen to their passion because that's kind of differentiates who you're talking to. Does somebody want to do this to get rich quick, or are they really excited and interested about the domain? And then you could kind of somewhat, you know, carefully challenge their assumptions. Is how do you know this? You know, were you working in this field, or have you talked to anybody? And pretty soon the first conversations usually are, gee, I'm happy to have another coffee if you're going to commit to at least talk to some people to validate your own assumptions. Because I usually say, why are you talking to me? Well, oh, we want your blessing. Am I your customer? No. Well, then therefore, you know, I'm not going to write you a check based on, I've maybe done that once because I think they did invent anti-gravity, but it's usually my shtick is I want to hear they've actually gone through some process.
Your point is well taken here, because the voice of the customer, the understanding of the needs and the problems, I mean, have to be understood. And quite frankly, a lot of companies still fall in love with the tech, right? They fall in love with the concept and the idea of being an entrepreneur, and package that together and you've got a great business. Well, it's missing a level or two.
Well, but let's be careful, Keith. There are some businesses that are fad driven or you know, VC lemming businesses that you don't need revenue for a long time, and it's the giant Ponzi scheme if you could take money out in each round. So let's not confuse building a product that customers want with how investors and potentially entrepreneurs could get liquid, that is, be able to take cash out of the business. The clearest example are all the AI, you know, things getting funded. Right. How many of them are actually delivering things that people want, or actually will be able to deliver things that people that could want and use? Some percentage, but certainly not all of them. But will entrepreneurs make money on more than the ones that deliver value? Absolutely, because we changed the rules in the 21st century of how founders can make money. It used to be in the 20th century, the only way you made money was if you went public. Being acquired was kind of a door prize back then, not a good one. And to go public, the investment banks, which were kind of boutique banks in San Francisco, wouldn't take you out unless you had four or five profitable quarters in the past with increasing revenue and could kind of, you know, unofficially guarantee them that that would continue for another year. So your investors taught you how to build companies that generated revenue and profit. You would only make money, and so would your investors, not on taking money off the table at each round, only at that IPO. Now, think about how the rules are changed today, right? VCs and their CEOs and the founding team can actually take money off at each increasing round. That's a very different game, and the motivations are changed. And therefore, it changes what VCs teach their founding teams to go do. Does that make sense? Because
no, it different actually does. But it actually has me thinking that at the present moment, what's old becomes somewhat new again, although it's different still. The idea of you having to show more profit and having a revenue path today seems more important than it was even 3 to 5 years ago.
Sure, but I'll contend, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to find a company with a unicorn valuation where the CEO didn't pull off a couple million dollars that just on the next round. In the 20th century, seriously, you were eating ramen was not some euphemism. You were eating ramen and making $60,000 a year as the CEO until you had a liquidity event or you went home.
Right, because your seed round was 500,000 versus 50 million.
You bet. So the word entrepreneur, venture capital, et cetera, startups, all are the same, but the business itself has changed radically since I've been in it. And that's good. I mean, it's not bad. Entrepreneurship has been democratized.
I was going to follow up on that point, Steve. Ask, what do you like and what don't you like about the current state of startup/VC/ecosystem and things getting more efficient, things getting more complex?
Well, let me start with the, you know, why it's I was about to say entrepreneurship has been globally democratized. You know, turn of the century is kind of an interesting intersection of the internet made information available anywhere and anytime. Before that, you were limited to your coffee bandwidth of having coffees with, CEOs and VCs on Sand Hill Road and other innovation clusters, which in the US were probably about two, one Boston and the other Silicon Valley. Now it's everywhere. Number two is, computing became a utility. When I was an entrepreneur, you had to buy a big mini computer or rent mainframe time, if anybody remembers what that is. Now you simply plug into the net and you're, on AWS or Azure or Google Cloud, et cetera. And so you have more computing that ever existed imaginable to build things without thinking about hardware as part of your spending budget. The third part I think we contributed to is that there's now a methodology. Rather than throwing stuff against the wall, the lean method and agile and all these other tool sets provide kind of founding CEOs a framework of what do you do at what time and how. And then finally, open source. Just imagine the role of GitHub and all the other open source vehicles. All those have just changed the velocity and then scale and the number of entrepreneurs. And then, of course, all the breakthroughs in technology. Yeah. So the answer is that's the good side. The opportunities are, huge. Technology opportunities are huge, et cetera. The bad side is, maybe it's the grumpy old guy, but just like I don't think there are a million world-class artists, even though we now have Photoshop and other tools, I don't think we have an infinite supply of world-class Elon Musk or Steve Jobs. Right. Though everybody can be a founder, just like everybody can try to, draw with Photoshop or Illustrator, et cetera. We'll talk about what AI will do to both Photoshop and entrepreneurship in a second. But it allowed infinite expansion past the carrying capacity, I think, of entrepreneurial culture. Does that make sense? Or?
No, totally. And I do want to jump into the AI discussion because it's so fraught with such fun, contrast, right? The unlimited potential with the unlimited risks. So I do want to get into that. Before I jump in there, a quick look back, Steve. You've done 1,000 startups, or I think your bio said 100 or something. But
no, I did 8 startups personally.
Personally, but you've been an advisor and a leader and to tons. You're well known in that respect. What were some of the ones?
My earliest one is when they invented the wheel.
We had that, and then there was fire. And
fire. I was also around for fire, right?
Which ones, do you kind of look back at? Not necessarily because it went the fastest to unicorn or IPO, but because it was just so interesting and unique. What were the ones that were either from the CEO founder standpoint or the idea standpoint? Which ones sort of stick with you a little bit?
They were the successes, failures, and the whatever are all equally interesting. I'll give you a couple and stop me when it rambles on. Actually, my first startup is actually kind of full circle where my career now is. Was a military intelligence company run by a PhD mathematician who eventually became the Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry. Wow. And the company was called ESL. And I accidentally, after coming out of the military, ended up in the middle of one of the largest programs in the Cold War, not by my skill, but just like, hey, you over here. And then maybe the next company, I did two chip companies, Zilog as a startup, one of the first microprocessor companies, and then MIPS Computers with John Hennessy and Skip Stritter and John Massouris. And both of those, surprisingly, I now sit on the technical advisory board for Applied Materials, a $20 billion company that makes the machines that makes the chips, the TSMC and others. So, but then the most interesting set of customers were we built a supercomputer company, which failed miserably. But boy, those customers were interesting, learning about computational fluid dynamics and computational chemistry and finite element analysis and being able to hold conversations about each. Even though the company didn't do well, I learned how to be a good marketeer there. And then Supermac got me into the consumer business. So, and that actually was a nice IPO. But the whole lean method actually came from my biggest failure my entire career, and that was rocket science. And you know, out of that came not only the lean startup method, but Peter Barrett runs Playbook, you know, which is one of the better VCs for early stage companies. And out of that came Epiphany, which you know, out of the grounds of failure, I took everything I learned about, particularly about hubris, but also about getting out of the building and listening closely to customers, and took that to an $8 billion market cap when that was a big number.
Right. A lot of those companies, successes or not, had their time in the sun for sure.
Right. And so, you know, and probably the smartest thing I did was my kids were still young, and rather than just doing it again, I wanted to see them grow up. So I invested in my family, and then ended up creating an academic career at first Berkeley in a business school, and now Stanford in both the engineering school, and then creating a national security center in Hoover and CSAC.
Let's go ahead and jump into that, Steve, because that is so interesting. And I have to admit, I even saw a recent post or two of yours speaking about the importance of defense, even though we are in this period where we have such a divided country and divided university population. I thought I have to ask you a little bit about some of these issues going on around campus that relate to war as you're trying to, one, be a great citizen, a model at Stanford, and involved with something that I think is a lightning rod for some debate, and you've experienced some of that. So maybe provide a little bit of context to that question, because I'm not as deep into what you're working on there in the defense side and the innovation side, but I'm fascinated by it. And, you know, I'm for one of those people that say, why do we need war? I don't want peace everywhere. But how realistic is that in the current world where we have, you know, hot spots all over the place? And just wouldn't it be nice if we could all get along? So I understand the needs for, you know, things such as, I don't know if Palantir or some of those other innovations have come out of this this effort, but I know military defense innovation is critical. And you know, protecting what we have is critical also. So I'm just curious to get your thoughts of what, understand what you're doing, and get your thoughts on the current scope of things.
Sure. And you know, let me start for, you know, your listeners. You know, at some point in your life, especially if you're doing the startup, your head is down and you're focused on 100%. And the biggest thing is, did your co-founder quit, or you're going to get that large customer, or you're going to close that next round?
Right.
But at some point, you step back and think about service. And for me, service meant, you know, a couple things. In maybe no particular order, but for me, it was, how did you serve God, country, community, and family? And I wanted to see if I could check those boxes. You know, I served in the military during Vietnam. I was a public official in California for 7 years. You know, our kids still come home in their 30s for holidays. So, you know, I'll blame that on my wife. But you only get your report card for your kids about after they leave. You know, I think I added value by not only the lean method, but teaching now multiple generations of students. And so for me, the being able to think about the problems I wanted to solve next, I think we took a good shot on building value for venture capitalists and people in our companies. I think we did a pretty fair deal for the rest of the entrepreneurial community with the work Eric Ries and Osterwalder and I did in building lean methodologies. And then I did some work for large companies, but, you know, they have enough resources to either, you know, creative destruction is going to take care of and that one way or another. But unlike companies that actually get created and new ones emerge, the one thing we can't afford to go out of business is national security. Because first of all, you have to decide, is there good and evil in the world? And if you think it's all good, then this is a moot conversation. If you think there, you know, that history says that there really is the duality of man, we could be incredibly compassionate and incredibly evil, and sometimes the same people. And then you kind of look back and say, what kind of problems do we need to solve? And for me, the place I thought I can contribute is that for the first time in the history of the United States, all the technology needed to defend us, let alone win a war, God forbid, but just defend the country, were no longer owned by our Department of Defense. That is, we used to own the most advanced weapon systems in the world, whether they were drones or satellites or something else. Literally, you turn around and drones are, you buy them from DJI. You know, satellites, that's a private company. SpaceX has put more stuff in orbit just last year than anything ever launched. AI machine learning, you know, certainly not owned by the Department of Defense. You know, cyber, same thing. You know, so you go down the list and then you go look at, you know, how is this stuff getting integrated? And the answer is the Department of Defense is having a major problem in integrating advanced technology and figuring out how to innovate at clock speed that China has. And the interesting thing is China operates like Silicon Valley, and the Department of Defense operates on a good day like General Motors. And that's not great for people who want to sleep safely in their beds. So the answer is I decided to help add some value to maybe solving some of these problems. And I think we've done that. Stanford, basically, if your listeners haven't seen The Secret History of Silicon Valley, it's a YouTube video, and it's also on my website, thesteveblank.com. There's a tab.
Yes, thanks for mentioning that. I was going to give you a plug too, because I really enjoyed it.
So it turns out that the Department of Defense is the reason why Silicon Valley exists. We forgot that because then commercial technology took over, and rightly so. But the valley is now kind of heading back that way. There's now, in the last 5 years, a ton of venture capitalists who have emerged who are focused on funding either what's called dual use technology that could be used for commercial and military uses, and already the Oracles and the Googles and the Microsofts, but also military only companies.
Right. The tech company's biggest customer was usually government, and a lot of times it was the defense side.
Right. And to be clear, Intel always claimed and Fairchild claimed, oh, the government wasn't our biggest customer. What they forgot to mention is, no, the government contractors were their biggest customers. So, you know, while Fairchild wasn't selling to the US government, they were selling to Autonetics that used them to their first integrated circuits were on the guidance systems in the Minuteman II warhead.
So dig in a little bit now and tell me what kind of stuff you're working on in the departments and the things that you're teaching.
You mentioned earlier the first class that scaled nationally was called it's still taught at Stanford after 2 decades now, called the Ling Launchpad. The National Science Foundation adopted it to commercialize all science, called the Innovation Course, taught in 100 universities. But about 8 years ago, we took that framework and said, how can we help national security? And so we've created a system where we go out to the Department of Defense and other parts of the national security establishment and get problems from them that students could select non-lethal problems like, you know, battlefield medicine or, you know, problems from the VA or problems in using AI for command and control, et cetera. And we let students pick on whether they want to work on those problems.
So
It's obviously
could they be biological kinds of things
they could
and
be,
cybersecurity things? Can they be drone technology? Yeah.
yes. And so we call this the same framework as the innovation classes and the National Science Foundation classes, but we renamed this Hacking for Defense. And the same year I started Hacking for Defense at Stanford, we also went out to the State Department and started Hacking for Diplomacy. So I started that with another Stanford professor, Jeremy Weinstein, and started Hacking for Defense with two retired Army colonels, Pete Newell and Joe Felter. Hacking for Defense is now scaled to 60 universities in 3 countries in the United States. So it's the second national class I had.
Wow.
And then the third thing we did was then realizing, if you remember my conversation about all this new technology, but the Department of Defense not being able to get their hands around it. Well, what better place than Stanford? That's the center of all this technology. Plus, Silicon Valley knows how to operate with speed and urgency and deliver things that matter quickly. So we started a center called this Gordian Knot Center for National Security Innovation that kind of integrates all those pieces. And we have not only classes on that called Technology, Innovation, and Great Power Competition, but we also have a bunch of students doing research on national security and technology intersection to help policy.
But where does this end? Where does this go from your class to, do people decide to launch companies out of this, or is there a, is there some sort of a incubator program?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So initially, I really didn't want to do an incubator, and I didn't want to do, I wasn't recruiting for, you know, services in the military or whatever. What I, my intent was, and you got to remember, this is 8 years ago, when there really was this huge divide between people who wanted to go to work for Google, thinking that everybody in the government was an idiot. And when in fact, I kind of knew they, that thinking that Google was working on the world's toughest problems was simply, you didn't have a clue what the world's toughest problems were. And so the intent of the class was to do some cross-fertilization of having students at least appreciate the size and scale and why they get to live in a free country, and have the military understand the types of technology. That was the only intent. Unfortunately, or fortunately for all sides, that's not how it ended up. Yes, that happened. And yes, everybody's taking this class now has a bigger appreciation of either side. But we've had some great companies spin out. Capella Space, which makes synthetic aperture radar satellites, which are over the Ukraine, started in our class.
You just
been for a while.
I was going to ask you, keep going. I want to hear about some of these technologies and where were they being deployed or implemented. And again, not by your direction necessarily, but with your stewardship, it's fascinating. We're talking about China and Taiwan and Russia and Ukraine and Gaza, et cetera.
Vannevar Labs, one of the best open source intelligence companies, started in our class. And the list goes on. But the other interesting thing was that students have who had never considered national service are now making some opt-in choices that, we never say you ought to go do X or Y. But I've had kids say, well, maybe I want to be a national security fellow, or maybe I want to do an internship in agency X or Y. We've even had folks decide to join up as a service just because they got interested and exposed to the both what, you know, students at this age are interested in mission-driven activities. How do I make the world better or make a change? Or what do I want to identify with? And I think, there are lots of opportunities in climate and energy and whatever, but national security is another one of those spaces that we've given them an opportunity to think about.
Isn't it interesting to think when you mentioned the thought of what is it called when you have to sign up for the military? I'm losing the word.
Enlist? Conscription?
Yeah. When you
draft?
Yeah. Doesn't you immediately go to boot camp and exercises down at the base where you could be sent to a tech lab to work on, you're more likely to be doing tech work and tech development?
Yes, or policy work, or thinking about national security policy, or thinking about cyber, or working on cyber projects, or working, I keep going to students who love to be challenged. And at this age, by definition, most of them are. If you want to work on some of the most complicated problems, and I'm just talking about technology, I'm talking about policy problems. Are we going to go to war for 2 nanometers? I mean, that's essentially what defense of Taiwan means, right? Because TSMC is the largest manufacturer by far of all the logic chips that everybody from Apple to our airplanes use. They're located in Taiwan. China thinks and says Taiwan is a breakaway province. Oops, that's an interesting solution. What you want to have happen is have China wake up every morning and say, not today. It's not going to work.
But it's a hard policy to manage.
Understand. So these are not just military solutions, they're policy conversations. And obviously that's what goes on in the highest level of this nation. But again, our students get to participate in some of those things. In our classes, we have speakers from the National Security Council. We have General Mattis, ex-Secretary of Defense. Condoleezza Rice, ex-Secretary of State, usually opens and keynotes our classes. You know, and then CTO of CIA and you know, generals from different parts of the Air Force, Army, Navy, etc., come speak. We even have the representative from the People's Republic of China give a counterpoint in one of our classes last semester, etc. So they can actually hear on the policy side. It's not just about technology. So when we teach policy in the Gordian Knot Center, they get to hear other sides. You know, that's a lot different from, you know, let me just sit and you know, get lectured at. They have to get engaged. And all these classes that we teach have a hands-on component, whether it's policy or technology.
Well, I mean, the idea of cybersecurity and biological warfare have changed the game dramatically. And the way you're going to solve for some of that is... it's good that that we can try to come up with some solutions for that.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. There's a book called, you mentioned cyber. I think it's called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, which is, I don't know if you've read it, but it's basically about how cyber has evolved past being owned. This is another area. National Security Agency used to own all the expertise for cyber and zero-day exploits, etc. And now there's a commercial market for jailbreaking and cracking your phones. And you want an iPhone or Android, you know, crack? Well, it cost you $2 million. So now there's a open source market for nation states and terrorists and others that have kind of escaped the confines of what governments used to own. And I use that as one example. I mean, ransomware, which we've all kind of been looking over our shoulders for, and institutions have been dealt with. That used to be a nation state thing, and now it's a criminal activity.
Look, it's brought down companies to a knee or two, and it could bring down countries at some point.
And Keith, I know you wanted to talk about startups, but
No. Startups are a part of it, but this is a layer of that. This is a really good, because if I think about it, Stephen, I was talking to a friend of mine and mentioned that I was going to speak to you. And he said, ask him about hackathons, because he's a very passionate, you know, guy who's worked with all of the developer community. Can you imagine hosting these hackathons in all of these problem areas that would act as a bookend to a lot of the higher education places that are working on these problems?
So here's my, not problem with the hackathon, but just a flag. So when we teach these get out of the building classes, like Hacking for Defense and Lean Launchpad and iCore, Here's the biggest thing we found is that whether you come in with your own thing you want to solve or build, or whether it's Hacking for Defense, you're working on a problem given it to you by someone, almost always the problem, as you discover, is a symptom of something much more interesting. And if all you would have done is build a solution to the problem as given you, that is, I'm not going to go talk to somebody. I got the problem. Thank you very much. We're very smart. Great. We'll just build a solution. You almost always discover, no, we don't need a new data lake. What we really needed was a way to connect with the existing systems we didn't even know existed. Does that make sense at all?
It does.
And so in a hackathon, you're typically assuming that the problem is given is the solution needed. And that's okay given the time frame you have. And there's no time to go investigate why was I given this problem. And sometimes it is a very specific, I need you to solve X.
Right.
But for most more interesting things, you know, there's people, there's institutions, there's other things going on. There's, you know, the org chart is never the influence chart inside of an organization. How does the money flow, et cetera? Unless you have, by the way, the one of the things we teach our students to ask is, who's the saboteur? In an organization of more than two people, one of them is a saboteur who doesn't want you in there for some reason. All those, I think, are the complexities of actually the difference between a demo and a deployed system at scale, whether that's commercial or military. But people could create great demos. But to create great companies requires deeper understanding of all the moving parts of how the technology gets bought, sold, used, and then deployed at scale, whether it's a consumer product. You know, how do I do a great CES demo to how do I have a this thing in the hands of 100 million people.
Yeah.
That's a very different model.
No, very similar. I spent a lot of time in research, and the one thing research proves is you need more research. What do you think about AI?
So wait a minute, let me give you my color.
Oh, okay.
My color that is, you know, a lot of people write a lot of great papers to admire problems. We teach people how to solve them. And it doesn't mean that you don't need the research, but that isn't an end to itself, right? The goal is, again, solving problems, delivering problems. I teach a class on this in Imperial College every summer in London, and we work on what are called wicked problems. Wicked problems are incredibly complex problems. That doesn't mean bad. It just means homelessness is a wicked problem. There's not one problem there. There's about 10 intertwined. Oh, one of the problems the students had was not only homelessness, there. Another one was an insurgency in the country of Chile. And the students flew from London and got out of the building and talked to the insurgents and the government and the farmers and the whatever, and discovered that, oh, this is a wicked problem. There's a whole bunch. And the insurgents had different rooms. Some didn't want to solve the problem. Others, you know, were interested in solution, etc. So there are kind of
go all the way there, by the way.
It turns out at Imperial they actually have a wicked problems lab, which I found really fascinating, and a professor named Cristobal Garcia invited me to co-teach this class with him, and we combined the research component, which there are great research tools for wicked problems.
Yeah.
But it had never been combined with getting out of the building. So the students went, what do you mean we're flying to Chile in the middle of the class? What do you mean we're going to X or Y? Yes, this is how we're going to go research this problem. Anyway, sorry for the digression.
No, the good digression. And let's go over to AI, and then I'll help you, you know, move that along, because it's so, it's the underpinnings of AI now are pretty amazing in terms of its ability to shake up everything we've talked about today. How do you evaluate it as both a catalyst for change for the positive or a challenge or a risk?
Well, for startups, I think it's going to be a you know, one of those great fake Chinese quotes, may you live in interesting times. It's going to be, AI is going to do to founders like it's going to do to programmers, right? Programmers in some cases are turning into prompt engineers rather than how good can you write Python. Right now it's right with Copilot, it's kind of turning into how good can you prompt Copilot to, you know, write your Python for you. For startups, if you really think about the whole lean and customer development model, if I was building a platform company, I'd be building an AI model, piece of enterprise software, because think about it, for at least let's take consumer products in the United States. Today, I could buy data that's pretty perfect about psychographic, geographic, demographic, whatever data. I mean, I'm tracking every place you've been. And so let's just assume that in some markets, I have perfect data. So think about what customer discovery is about. Customer discovery is, I want to test a series of hypotheses against people about products or buying habits, etc. Well, if I have perfect data, why do I need to talk to human beings? I'll contend we could probably have enough data today to create remember, AI, even ChatGPT, is basically taking a unique data set, in their case, the web, but imagine taking a specific consumer slice and building an AI against that. And now I have a million personas I could create, and now I could start asking it questions. And then I could say, okay, let's do some customer validation. So I did discovery against this AI. Well, how would I do that? Well, typically the best validation is, will someone buy something? Well, the way you would do that is you'd create a website and normally a human being and list a couple of products and start creating demand. Well, I could, it's not, AI is already creating websites. Imagine I could create 1,000 websites. Well, then I need to build the products. No, just auto-generate the pictures. So what I'm describing is, we can imagine already, nothing I just said is science fiction anymore. Those components exist. No one is, I don't think yet, taking those vertical data slices, But I just said, imagine consumer products, but imagine I'm the National Health Service in the UK, and I own all the personal health data of every citizen of the United Kingdom. Imagine I built an AI that kind of do an end-to-end process for what drugs to prescribe and when and what products to kind of pitch. I mean, you could imagine if you own those data, the whole lean methodology no longer either requires a human being or better is 100 to 1,000x force multiplier for those who can use it versus those who are still doing it manually. Does that help for a vision? So is that frightening or is that encouraging? Well, I think it's incredibly encouraging. It's like what computers and the internet did combined to all the manual processes before. In fact, the best picture I like to illustrate this is all the way to the 1960s, if you went to an insurance company anywhere in the world, they had an entire room of people on manual IBM calculators calculating actuarial tables for individuals. You know what that room looks like today? It's the storeroom. Not only is the room empty, the job doesn't even exist before. Right. Or remember scenes of Wall Street of people running around, you know, waving tickets and for stock pickers? That's already automated. I mean, so there's entire industries that have kind of been creatively destroyed with jobs that just no longer exist. Computers used to be manual people, not automated machines. I think we're going to see the same thing, particularly for founders and entrepreneurs, are not going to go away, but the amount of machine stuff behind them, we ain't seen anything yet.
Yes, I agree. Ed, change is the only thing constant out there. It keeps us busy. I mean, did you ever think when you were doing SuperMac and rocket science, you'd be at Stanford teaching innovation and defense?
No. No, though, as I said, it is kind of full circle. I never actually thought about this way when I had an entrepreneurial career, but it is the bookends to my career. I started in a military career and serving in some way but this goes back to, you know, what is your philosophy for what kind of life do you want to live? Right. You know, God, country, community, family. I'll suggest to your listeners, if you don't have some kind of mantra of what it is you want to live for, I mean, pick your family or pick something that you stand for, you know, or else it becomes just a chase for the next IPO or the next liquidity event. Listen, there's nothing wrong with collecting toys, trust me. And I'm glad I was able to do that. Yes. But to be honest, that's not what gives me the greatest kind of satisfaction, is to be able look back and, well, it's less so mojo and look back and say, well, did I affect anything? And teaching allows me to affect, or in good or bad, generations of students and some of the other things I did, I hope made the world a better play.
Eve, fantastic. Thanks for your time. I've taken way too much of it. I let you get back to all the interesting things that you're working on. For my listeners that want to stay close to you, steveblank.com, conventional spelling. I'll get this podcast out too, and we'll refer back to some of the other great things you shared. And it's been wonderful.
Thanks, Keith. These are great questions, and I enjoyed the time.
Oh, continued success on that path and that journey. And I encourage people to really check out some of your work. The history of Silicon Valley?
History of Silicon Valley.
Secret History of Silicon Valley on YouTube. It's fantastic. Please check it out. Thanks again, Steve. Great talking with you.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to The Look Back. We do appreciate your support, welcome any feedback, and would love it if you would subscribe to this podcast and even consider sharing it with some of your friends. For more information and other cool info, check us out at newmanmediastudios.com.